Hey, this is Mark in San Antonio, Texas. I love the Gospel Tangents podcast because it has some of the best and most diverse guests in the field of Mormon studies.
Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. Not everyone agrees that the documentary hypothesis is the best explanation for the Old Testament. It turns out that European and American scholars disagree about the documentary hypothesis. In our next conversation, we'll talk about more about these differences. Check out our conversation.
So that leads up to Wellhausen, and his whole project was quite a bit different from those earlier scholars.
All right, yeah, we took a big detour there. We'll go back to them. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but he came up with a P source then.
He didn't come up with it.
Oh, he didn't.
Yeah, no. And really, the P source was Jean Ostrux E.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. So the priestly source, the priestly creation is Genesis 1. It was just that earlier scholars called that the Eloist source, so they called it E. But it wasn't really that Wellhausen came up with those different sources at all. Throughout the whole 19th century, scholars were talking about Deuteronomy as a source, the priestly source, J source, E source. They were talking about all of those different sources. It was just that Wellhausen came up with a historical argument that synthesized all of that material into one argument.
So how does P relate to E then now?
So if we're talking about now, Wellhausen's documentary hypothesis became pretty widely accepted by the end of the 19th century and the early 20th, to the point where scholars started to fragment those sources down even further. And it got to be pretty intense throughout the 20th century, especially in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And it wasn't until the late 1970s that German scholars started to question that model, the documentary hypothesis.
Okay.
That was through the influence of form criticism. Form criticism is another tool that scholars use to try to understand the history, but also the purpose of why texts are written. What sort of purpose in real life would they have had for the author and the audience? And so Sitz im Leben, the setting in life, is a phrase that you'll see a lot.
I'm going to have to give a spelling on that one.
Yeah, I'll give it to you. Yeah. So that was really key to trying to understand the historical writing of all parts of the Hebrew Bible. And so essentially some scholars in the late 1970s, Rolf Rentorf and a handful of others, started to question the documentary hypothesis and say that, well, through form criticism, we've been able to go through and actually cut down, particularly for the Torah, for the Pentateuch, to cut down all of the discrete individual units of the text. And we've been able to do that so successfully that it doesn't make sense anymore that we have these lengthy sources that are narratives that run from the beginning to end. And so since the 70s up until today, there's been this ongoing debate, and partially because of, that happened in the 70s, and you have the political difficulties in Europe and the U.S. At the time, after the Cold War and all of that, and then a breakdown of communications between German scholars and American scholars, that American scholars continued on with the documentary hypothesis, and in German scholarship, and then that affected the rest of continental and British European scholarship on the Pentateuch. Essentially, you have all of those scholars, the huge majority of them today, don't accept the classical documentary hypothesis. And that's where I've kind of come in with my career in biblical studies, is sort of just watching scholars try to engage and re-engage and read each other's literature and understand why over the last 40 years they've gotten so distanced from each other and how they can sort of bridge the divide.
Yeah, because I've heard that some people don't like the documentary hypothesis. But so you're saying essentially they've fragmented it so much that now it doesn't make sense anymore.
No. At the beginning of the 20th century, to a certain extent, yes. I'd have to point to some really specific studies for you, but it got to the point where it was getting a bit much, where people were, I mean, it's already, the documentary hypothesis is a hypothesis with a lot of evidence. You know, it's not just a random theory that a bunch of scholars just sort of throw themselves behind and they accept. It really, in its broad claims, has a lot of support. And even with the fragmentation in the 1970s of scholarship on the documentary hypothesis, European scholars never left the documentary hypothesis altogether. So they still accept P, they still accept D, and then besides those two sources, there's non-P and there's non-D.
Oh, we've gotten rid of J and E altogether.
Yep. That was the main thing, was that, you know, particularly through Wellhausen's work, where he had a really big difficulty with extracting E from J. As scholarship continued to develop, a lot of German scholars in particular kept saying that, J and E, there really isn't a whole lot that points to this actually being a narrative source that runs through. It's more likely that those sources are just pieces, their own individual pieces. Genesis 2 through 4 is probably its own piece. A lot of German scholars today argue that Genesis 2 through 4 in particular was influenced by Deuteronomy and Deuteronomistic theology, a centralizing idea of the holy place, the temple, along with other arguments. So just those kinds of things. So right now you have continental European scholarship and most British scholars who don't accept the classic documentary hypothesis, but accept a version of it. Going back a little bit before Wellhausen, but really it's not that different. One of the leading scholars in this field has actually estimated that it's a huge huge chunk of the Pentateuch altogether. Most scholars actually agree on what to identify it as. Like P and D is a huge chunk of the Torah. And most scholars actually agree pretty well on what is P and what is D. It's just mainly on J and E, or non-P and non-D, that they disagree with.
I like J and E better.
It's, right.
It's yeah. More catchy.
Yeah. Well,
I guess my question is then, so... Was it
Asherah?
Guy who figured out the difference between Jamie.
What was that? Oh, the early one? Jean Astruc.
Astruc.
Yeah.
So, but because from what I understand, mm-hmm. you know, we're switching the name of God between J and E. So mm-hmm. if E has essentially become P, mm-hmm. we still have this issue about Yahweh and mm-hmm. Elohim. Mm-hmm. I guess current scholarship is saying those are just interchangeable, or I don't understand.
Well, essentially, you know, if you were talking to a German scholar today who looks at that, if they were only looking at the beginning chapters, if they were looking at Genesis 1 and then Genesis 2 through 4, they would say that those are two different authors. It's just that the main difference between maybe Conrad Schmidt, who's a leading scholar in Germany, between him and one of the leading scholars here in America, Joel Baden at Yale Divinity School, the difference between them isn't that they're identifying those as different sources. They actually agree. It's just that Joel Baden thinks that Genesis 2 through 4 is a discrete text, so a unified text and identifiable text that runs from Genesis 2, 4b, so the last half of verse 4, that if you go throughout the whole Torah, you can actually piece that narrative and that text together up until Deuteronomy 34.
Hmm.
So that's the main difference between scholars right now.
Because don't they continue to switch between Yahweh and Elohim throughout Genesis?
Yeah, he's not arguing that from Genesis 2 through Deuteronomy 34, that all of that is J. It would be jumping around quite a bit. You'd be taking out a lot of that text to get J, especially Deuteronomy. You know, he doesn't argue that any of Deuteronomy, except for some of the chapter 34, was written by J. So you'd be getting a whole lot less of Genesis 2 through Deuteronomy 34 with what Joel Baden is arguing is J. But that's the difference between the two of them. Conrad Schmidt might think that some of that the author of Genesis 2 through 4 wrote some other parts, maybe, of Genesis, but it's not going to be very much, if it is any. And he might even just think that Genesis 2 through 4, that was written at a specific moment, and it doesn't necessarily connect with any of the rest of the Torah. So as far as authorship goes.
All right, so where are we at today with, because it seems like some scholars don't like the documentary hypothesis, and then we've also got the biblical literists who I assume would hate it.
Right, yeah, no. A lot of people really don't like it still, and there have been a handful of different attempts by more traditionally minded scholars to sort of come up with new methods and new approaches to explain all of the problems that we've been talking about the formation of the Pentateuch particularly. A lot of people really don't like it, but really, a lot of the time, like, there are a handful of scholars that try to say, oh, well, this fragmentation of the scholarship obviously makes it so that the documentary hypothesis goes away, and then we don't have the problem of, you know, the five books being written later. But none of that goes away. If you don't accept the documentary hypothesis, that's fine. There's a whole lot of evidence to support a version of the documentary hypothesis. So really the main competing arguments right now within scholarship are what I described. So you can either go with the documentary hypothesis, which tends to argue that the different sources were written a little bit earlier. So maybe the earliest of those would be 8th, 9th century BCE, which I haven't mentioned yet, is really early for writing, lengthy writing in Hebrew, at least, because one of the main arguments that really sort of shuts down the possibility of Moses being the author of the Torah is the fact that written Hebrew didn't develop until after Moses' life.
Moses didn't speak Hebrew?
He would have spoken it, probably a version of it, a much earlier version of it. But yeah, he wouldn't have written it, not in the form and in the linguistic linguistic form, I guess, is really the best phrase I should have used, that the Torah is written in. It doesn't develop until after his life. So there are continuing debates about that as well. What does that mean for the writing of it? But really, most scholars, pretty much all scholars that are really engaged in Pentateuchal criticism, agree that Moses couldn't have written it, and that the five books of Moses couldn't have come together until at the very earliest, the return from the Babylonian exile, which also has other implications.
What year is that approximately?
That would have been 530 BCE or okay. So toward the end of the 6th century BCE. And so that's the earliest that they would have been compiled together. That's like more
so
conservative.
The Torah would have been compiled, and I'm going to try to put this in Book of Mormon terms.
Right.
The Torah, the five books of Moses, uh-huh. would have been written long after Lehi left Jerusalem.
Compiled in the five books, yes.
And that's an interesting, that leads into your paper, doesn't it?
A little bit. Yeah, there's definitely some connections there. Yeah, if we're shifting gears here.
Before we go there, because I still want to hit this idea of, you know, what do faithful Latter-day Saints and even faithful Christian scholars do? Do they just, because it seems like, at least in my Sunday school classes, when we do talk about the Old Testament, ain't nobody talking about the documentary hypothesis.
Yeah, no.
We're just going to take it on faith. Moses wrote these first five books, take it or leave it, and we're going to take it.
Right, and even if it comes up.
Yeah. And so, you know, people might get into, did the flood really happen? Were Adam and Eve real people?
Yeah.
But nobody's going to spend any time on the documentary hypothesis.
Uh-huh.
And I think most people are going to just say Moses wrote all five books.
Probably.
And a story.
Yeah.
And so how is there a way to talk to people and get them to understand the documentary hypothesis? Or should we just leave them alone and say,
yeah,
I don't believe that way?
You know, it's really up to each person's, you know, perspective, I guess. You know, I'm this has been kind of annoying to some people over the years, but I tell people, like, I'm not a theologian. I'm a historian. So I'm trying to understand the, you know, as best as we can with the tools and the methods and the sources that we have today, the actual writing of those texts. And so as far as an individual person, whatever their religious faith is, wants to understand the history of the Bible, I approach it, you know, as if we're sitting in a college class and we're just talking about, you know, all of those basic points and the things that we've discussed and more. There are lots of other things that we could go over. And it's more of a history lesson, right? A literary lesson as well, because, like I said, the history does affect how we understand the different stories in Joshua. But really, ultimately, it's sort of a literary question of, okay, well, what is the author of that text trying to say to their audience? We know this about history, that Jericho didn't actually collapse because the wall didn't go around the whole city. But what would that have? What does that mean about the author then? What are they trying to say to their supposed audience that we suppose they're writing to? So yeah, it's really up to each individual. If, you know, like some people, if they're talking to me, they're probably already interested in that to a certain extent.
Most
you know?
Sunday school papers, people are going to be like, stay away from Colby.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So you know, and it's not like I just sort of bring that up out of nowhere. This is sort of my career path, and this is what I study, and this is what I spend my time, you know, engaging. So, yeah, it kind of just depends. But if people are interested in it and they have questions, and as we chat, I give them as much information as they want. So,
all right. Yeah. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with biblical scholar Colby Townsend. In our next conversation, we'll talk about secret combinations, which are mentioned in the Book of Mormon. Are there other references to secret combinations that existed in the days of Joseph Smith? Colby tells us about a French group.
When you look at newspapers of that period, in the late 18th century, the phrase secret combination starts to pop up a lot, and in particular against the Jacobins. So one of the documents that I looked at in that chapter was a review of a recent history. This is in the late 1790s. It was an American review of a French history of the Jacobins.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please subscribe to patreon.com/gospeltangents. And for just $5 a month, you can hear the entire interview without any interruption. If you'd like a paperback version of our transcripts, go to amazon.com and do a search for Gospel Tangents interview. Also, if you'd like to give the money to me and not Amazon, please subscribe on my website, and I'll be able to send you a transcript as soon as they are completed, and click the subscribe button. You can also find our latest information on facebook.com/gospeltangents, as well as we're on Twitter @gospeltangents. And don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts. The link is at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents, and you can subscribe there. Also, please give us a 5-star review. If you want to support all of the podcasts as part of the Dialogue Podcast Network, go to lyceum.fm, that's lyceum.fm, and do a search for Dialogue Podcast Network or Gospel Tangents, because, you know, that's a pretty cool one too. Thanks again for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some of our great videos. Thanks again.